Welcome, everyone. I hope that, well, I look forward to working with you again.
Okay. And let's get into the first item on the agenda, which is the work plan update.
Okay, so the first paper, agenda paper one, is the work plan. I am Alan Teixeira for these purposes. Three of us will be presenting the work plan to you. We're going to do a high-level discussion of the main projects because there's a lot of information on here. And then Michael will point out some of the narrow scope amendments, if you have any questions on any of the items on this, please feel free to ask. Some of these may obviously be redundant to what we're discussing. You may have already heard this, but I'll try to go through. We'll go through this relatively quickly so we have time for questions. So if you turn to the agenda paper one, we have the work plan on the second page. And as background to this, this is all the topics that are on our agenda. We update the work plan after every board meeting. So any changes, what this does is shows the projects we're working on and the timing for the documents that we're planning on publishing or issuing. So the projects could be related to what we call discussion papers that we talked about yesterday at the induction meeting. So papers where we're going out and trying to get views on a topic, but the board may not have formed views. The work plan could also include when we're going to issue exposure drafts. So that is more when the board has a view on which direction they think the project might be going, and they're basically putting those views out for comment. I should step back. The discussion paper is not part of our due process, is it? We don't have to publish a discussion paper. We don't have to publish a discussion paper. The exposure draft is required as part of our due process. And then the final document, if we go to final document, would also be listed in the work plan. So if we go to the first section, this is about our financial instruments projects. And the first project we have on here is our amendments to classification and measurement. Now, I won't talk about this at all because we will go through this in more detail during the today session. The only thing I will mention is that we've already published an exposure draft. We published that a few months ago. Our comment period, so when people send their comments on the exposure draft, will end the end of this month. And so we'll be going through deliberations on the proposals and on the comments received in the second quarter, starting the second quarter of this year, and that's what the work plan tells you. The next line is impairment. So our impairment project, I think I would make the assumption most of you have at least probably heard of it, but basically the impairment project is relating to issues people have had about the incurred loss model today, concerns about impairment provisions not being recognized in a timely manner. Our model, we were working with the FASB on our model, which is an expected loss model, so hopefully recognizing provisions in a more timely manner. We have a little bit of a different proposal right now than the FASB. The FASB went out with their exposure draft at the end of last year. Our exposure draft actually should be coming out today, we hope. So those are the proposed models that will be, both of the boards will be proposing. And although our models look a little bit different, and when I say they look different, the timing of the recognition of the total lifetime loss on that loan looks different between our two models. So I should step back. We're talking about instruments that are amortized. We're talking about financial assets that a company owns, that a company has invested in, that they're measuring at amortized cost today. How are they, if these items are impaired, when will they recognize and what's the measurement? So that's what this project is about. After our exposure draft is published, we'll have a 3-month comment period. Four months. I'm already trying to rush the project. 4-month comment period. We'll be looking at the comments that the FASB receives. We'll also obviously be looking at the comments we receive. We'll be discussing, we'll be having open communications between both boards during this process and also after the comment periods. And then we'll see what happens with the models. And I think at the end of this session, we'll talk about whether, you know, we'll have impairment come to CMAQ at the next CMAQ meeting. Hedge accounting. We have already gone through the process of issuing our discussion paper and our exposure draft, so we're on to our final document. The staff had posted a near final draft on our website last year, and we received some what we call fatal flaw comments, which really basically means we asked people to read the document to tell us if there's anything in there that would cause it's not a conceptual question. It's basically, is there anything that's going to be a...
Where the wording doesn't reflect the decisions of the board.
And if there's unintended consequences is what I was trying, the wording I was trying to say. We have had a few comments back that the board has discussed about hedge accounting, the hedge accounting model that we have finalized, basically, that the board, I think, will be discussing. We discussed a little bit of these questions in January. A couple more questions have come up that will be discussed in March. But we hope to finalize our hedge accounting requirements by the second quarter, and that will be put into our financial instrument standard, our new standard, which is we call IFRS 9. So this new hedge accounting model, which is supposed to better reflect risk management activities, it's supposed to be less structure around the effectiveness testing. So it's supposed to be a more fluid model with, and also with better disclosures, should hopefully be finalized by second quarter. This is separate from the macro hedging, accounting for macro hedging project, which we also talked about yesterday at the induction, which is the next line item on the work plan. This is a new project. This is a new concept. This is addressing entities that have open, they're managing their risk more on a portfolio basis, and it's a dynamic open portfolio where their exposures are coming in and out all the time. Banks also often use this to manage their interest rate risk, and the accounting, the hedge accounting requirements we have today, and also just our mixed measurement model and accounting, so with fair value, amortized cost, isn't allowing the accounting to really reflect what the risk management activity is. And so we've just started, well, we've been doing a lot of, we've had a lot of discussions with preparers, I think, over the last year about potential model for this macro hedging activity. And we are now starting to talk to investors and users as well. But that we're still in a very early stage, so we'll be issuing a discussion paper. We hope to publish a discussion paper in the first half of this year, and that will be with a lot of the research we've done, and so we can get ideas back on this. I should mention that this model will be separate from our financial instrument standard, because we know that people are asking us to get going with our financial instrument standard, you know, make it effective. So this accounting for macro hedging will not hold up the financial instrument standard. That's my short. Are there any questions on this, or would you like to move forward on the rest of the?
Shall I pick up some of the next batch? Insurance contracts, we're planning to put out a second exposure draft in the second quarter, probably. And we've got a session on that later today, so I won't say any more about that now. On leases, we're also aiming for a second exposure draft, and again, that's also likely to be in the second quarter. Skipping on to revenue recognition, that's one where we've been through two exposure drafts, and the plan is to issue a final standard around about mid-year.
Rate regulated activities, that's one of the new projects that was added to the board's agenda after the agenda consultation. We're talking here about the accounting for the rights and the obligations that a regulator will give a company operating in a regulated market, usually sort of utility companies, that sort of thing, a right to increase their prices or an obligation to decrease their prices in the future based on sort of cost patterns that have been experienced in the past, and whether or not those rights and obligations lead to assets and liabilities that should be recognised. We have a comprehensive project on this that will be working towards a discussion paper at the end of the year. We had previously issued an exposure draft on this back in 2009, but the responses we received were split pretty much 50-50 as to whether or not these rights and obligations do lead to assets and liabilities. And so we're starting at this at a more conceptual basis. And our next step in that project is to issue a request for information to get more information about the nature of the sorts of regulatory environments in which companies are operating. I mentioned utilities because they're the most common ones, but there are some other industries that can be affected. And what we're principally talking about is price regulation, where the regulator sets the price and determines what costs a company can recover through its operations. We're also setting up a consultative group to assist us on that project, and we're just in the process of identifying members for that. We'd had a request for nominations just recently. Connected with that project is we're working on an interim exposure draft. Now, this is targeted at companies that are not yet on IFRS, that perhaps are already recognising these regulatory assets and liabilities in their previous, their national GAAP financial statements. And the objective here is to enable them to continue to recognise those assets and liabilities when they adopt IFRS, but to separate out that effect very clearly on the balance sheet and in the income statement, so that you've got the IFRS information for all their other aspects of their activities, and then separately indicating the effect of these regulatory mechanisms. That is intended to just be a temporary standard that would then be withdrawn when we conclude on the comprehensive project. And the objective there is to sort of remove what is perceived by some as obstacles to the adoption of IFRS. Then,
may I ask a question on this? Is it, basically, it almost implies that the board already made a fundamental choice that there will be.
Absolutely not.
No?
Absolutely not.
So, what does the board say to those countries that then are brought within IFRS and then maybe within 2 years? The board says, well, we're not, I don't think it's a great idea. We don't think it's a great idea.
It's the same as insurance and extractive industries. It's exactly the same as we did in those circumstances. So we didn't have an insurance standard. We still haven't got an insurance standard. So we said to people, well, you can carry on doing what you're doing until we get a standard, and then you can apply the standard. And it's the same situation.
So possibly...
Yeah, possibly...
possibly 20 years from now, some countries...
It could be that some countries that are... Or some companies, we should talk about, really, that are currently recognising an asset or a liability in regard to this might have to come to a situation where they don't recognise an asset or a liability.
And I think Ian's point is maybe the most important one there. This is a very restricted standard that can only be used by people who are currently using within their own GAAP. Currently using something that allows them to recognize assets and liabilities. What we didn't want to do is almost the exact opposite of what you were saying, is have a situation where they switched to IFRS, and then in 2 years' time when the standard came out, had to switch back to what they'd been previously doing. So it's just to give us time to develop a standard. If that standard then says no assets and liabilities, then they've run out of runway. They've then got to change at that point.
I'm clear.
But there is certainly no presumption of what the answer is. Because it's a very difficult problem.
Yes.
Do you have any advice on this issue?
Do we have any advice?
If you ask my opinion, I may give it. Huh? I do have an advice, and I think it's. I think if such a standard were to be effective on rate-regulated activities, I think. It would limit the analyst audience that is able to interpret those companies, because they would not be familiar with those assets and liabilities and would have a really hard time expanding their universe that they could analyze to those companies that apply those that standard. So I do worry about that. I think probably a lot of the things that companies want to communicate about their regulatory environment is they could communicate that via descriptive information instead of the standard instead of in the primary financial statements. And apart from that, I think there is a lot of similarity between take-or-pay contracts and rate-regulated activity. And why not create a asset for a take-or-pay contract and allow an asset for a rate-regulated activity? Probably the take-or-pay contract is much more strict than the ever-changing regulatory environment. But that's in three words.
Cool. It'll be an interesting discussion paper when it comes out, because it will cover all those sort of arguments.
And where's your next exposure draft?
discussion paper.
Yep.
Yeah, but I mean, we haven't decided on the topic finally, so we will listen to opinions, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Before I move on to the narrow scope amendments, Daryl, did you want to say anything about the IFRS for SMEs?
Certainly. Just very high level. We're in the process at the moment of going through the review of the IFRS for SMEs. We had an initial meeting a couple of weeks ago of the small SME implementation group, which effectively has made recommendations for the board to consider. So the board will be considering what changes, if any, to make to the SME standard over the course of the next 3 months. We'll then get an ED out with those changes in probably in about July. That's where we stand on that one.
How commonly used is the IFRS for SMEs?
From the information we've got at the moment, very commonly used, substantially more than full IFRS, largely because of the size of the companies that we're talking about. So there's a very substantial amount of companies in that category. And also it's fairly broadly used, about 80, 85 countries at this stage. So within the countries that it's used, you find that 80 or 85% of the companies that are using IFRS overall are going with the IFRS for SMEs package.
Is there any regions? Spread?
It is not used at the moment in Europe. So predominantly the regions that we're looking at are South America, substantial parts of Africa, and some Asian countries are using it.
Yeah, and the UK is adopting.
And the UK is adopting something very similar to it. Countries like Malaysia are in the process of going through an exposure process to decide whether or not they're going to use it.
But is it used in addition to what we want to call the true IFRS, or is it used?
The entry criteria for IFRS for SMEs is it needs to be a company that does not have public accountability. And then we define public accountability as a company that doesn't have listed shares or listed debt or doesn't hold assets on behalf of the public in a fiduciary situation. So that counts out all your listed companies, it counts out all of your banks and other financial institutions. Outside of those then, outside of that exclusion, yes, it is widely used. And then it's used by companies who only use it.
I can add, actually, that we in Sweden have recently introduced something similar to the IFRS for SMEs. That took us 7 years, so I hope that the revisions that you are planning are not substantial.
I think the primary intent, and it is a fair point, it was a fairly big discussion at the implementation group. We want to make as limited changes as possible, and we've already decided as part of the original implementation process of SMEs that we would only make changes every three, or we would only review for changes every 3 years. So try to create, insofar as possible, a stable platform. And that's both because it's quite difficult to execute the changes, but also because we assume we're dealing with corporates that have got limited resources to actually keep up with changes. So stability is more important than anything else. Jane?
Yeah, having said that, though, there's a couple of things coming up. Leases would be a good example, which would have quite a big impact on small companies. So how big is that? We obviously haven't got it yet for big companies. So how big a lag would there be after it being imposed on quoted companies before it was then translated into IFRS fees? And I don't know whether it's not how much simplification of the standard could take place between the two.
It's probably early days for me to give you an answer on that. What I can tell you is what the SMIG group has recommended, so our consultancy group on SMEs, and their recommendation is that we should allow any new standards that come through IFRS to at least have a bedding down process in IFRS before they're introduced to SMIG. And the reason for that is twofold. First one is to just get an understanding of how it works in process, how it actually is working out there, possibly even to consider going through the post-implementation review process to understand what the issues are, so that you're not amending something. The second reason is that it gives us time to get an understanding of how it works in practice from the perspective, is it relevant to SMEs? And that then goes back to our point about the stable platform. But I should say, as I said, that's very much a recommendation. It's one of the issues the board will actually be discussing at the March board meeting.
Is it worth you commenting on the discussion that the implementation group had about whether to change the criteria for application of the SME and, you know, the question about the statutory?
Absolutely, I can definitely go into that. One of the issues that's being raised is that, as I mentioned earlier when I spoke about this public accountability definition, the public accountability definition specifies specifically any listed companies are disqualified from using it, and any financial institutions because they have public accountability. What we've heard back in some of the commentary on the request for feedback was that in a number of countries you have what are listed exchanges, but effectively they're unregulated exchanges, they're over the counter, there's no actual analysis of the companies in there because the companies are very, very small. And the question was asked of us whether or not we felt that those companies should be allowed to use IFRS for SMEs. The recommendation that we're making to, or that the SMIG is making to the board, is that we should at least consider it, but we should look to pass that responsibility on to the regulator in the individual countries. And say regulators in the individual countries need to decide whether particular listed companies are so small that they should consider actually using IFRS for SMEs. Similarly, with financial institutions, in a number of countries, you've got credit unions that are very, very small. I've actually seen a couple on a recent trip I've taken to South America that are really so small that effectively what they've got is they've got assets of $20 or $30 million, that's it. They operate within a single community, and there's nobody within that community who has the capacity to understand a full set of IFRS financial statements anyway. So they're producing these financials where they're not really used effectively. So again, the same consideration with the recommendation from the SMIG would be exactly the same, that we remove the paragraph that strictly bans public accountability, but make it very clear that this is a decision that regulators in particular jurisdictions need to make, and make it also very clear that the intent with IFRS for SMEs is not for financial statements that are intended for wide distribution. So regulators in making their decision, in coming to that decision, need to take that into account. Robert.
A couple of comments on the process. Users generally have been very much against SME-type standards because of a slippery slope problem. Where do you draw the line? Canada, and the second piece is that there's a conceptual framework problem, because what is different about an SME that would require a different measurement and a different disclosure package? The Canadians got around this problem by sort of an intellectual leap of faith, which was that that what is different about the SMEs is that their investor base is different, and they have a different relationship with the company. In essence, the ability to ask for more information if they knew what questions they could ask. From a practical point of view, what happened in Canada was that's the theory, but then the SME users said, and particularly the banks actually said, you know, in theory we can ask for more information, but in practice we get pushback from the marketplace, so the Canadian SME actually has quite a bit of disclosure. But the underlying assumption they made was these people can ask for more information. So when you look at revising it for the global SME standard, you really need to think carefully about what you're doing. And one of my concerns about allowing local regulators to do it is that they're going to be under intense pressure to, and the problem, there's a creep issue. If it's good for an SME over the counter, why isn't it good for somebody on the NASDAQ? And then if it's on the NASDAQ, why isn't it good for, you know, so there is a boundary issue that you need to be very careful about when you go through your thought process.
I think that you have probably encapsulated a lot of the discussion that happened at the board this month. It's precisely that concern. And interestingly enough, a lot of the assumptions that we made from a SMIG perspective, say the recent trip I've taken, speaking to regulators were telling me how much they rely on the IFRS financial statements to give that additional information to them. So it suggests that even there's something we may need to think about. The assumption we would have had is regulators are the most empowered to ask for the additional information they want. And this seems to suggest that may not be the case. So I think that's pretty much the debate that's going to be had. Ian?
There's a reality check too. I was chairman of the UK board, and we started out to introduce IFRS for SMEs. And then there are a couple of bits we didn't like tax, you know, where they anticipated the new tax standard. And so we didn't want to bring that in for the SMEs. But the reality is people don't care so much what you call it. So in the UK, they haven't called it IFRS for SMEs. They've used the IFRS for SMEs as a basis. and then they've changed some things, and they call it UK GAAP for smaller entities. And that's the reality around the world. I don't think we've got a product. I mean, it's a good product, and people use it, but we haven't got a product that people want to use that branding on. Different from IFRS, where you're really looking at cross-border transactions and all that sort of thing. So we can put whatever restrictions we like in our document, and you can say that you're leaving it to the regulators, but it'll be up to the regulators anyway, whatever we say in that document. And history has shown that they'll change it to what they want. So Canada could have picked it up as a basis and then worked for it. The US could pick it up as a basis and worked for it. They've decided not to. But to my mind, it's a very good starting point. And for instance, the small credit unions, the UK's allowed them to use the SMEs. That's just slippery slope. I tried at the beginning not to have any exemptions from the SME, but the tax was so blindingly obvious. And then once you allowed one, then everybody wrote in for others. So,
the reason Canada, I actually directly participated in the creation of the Canadian SME, and the reason we went with a Canadian standard is actually the Canadian SME standard was inspired conceptually in some ways from the IFRS one, but it was a transition issue. It was better in Canada to take the existing body, which was quite large, and simplify it. It was less of a transition gap than it, a transition step than it would have been to pull IFRS SME into Canada.
Whereas in the UK, we were on IFRS, so it's a different transition. Yeah.
I think perhaps we move on with the agenda now, but this might suggest that SMEs is a topic that we might want to talk about in a future discussion.
I was just thinking about that.
Okay. The narrow scope amendments, the implementation generally, these are small amendments that we're in the process of working on, primarily addressed at addressing diversity in practice. So that's the, sort of the main driver behind many of these. Now, there's a lot here, so I'm not going to go through each one. One that I'll highlight in particular is novation of over-the-counter derivatives and continued designation for hedge accounting. That was an exposure draft that was published last week with a very short 30-day comment period. That one is all about allowing companies to continue to apply hedge accounting without interruption in the circumstance where they've been required by a change in laws and regulations to novate an existing over-the-counter derivative that they had designated as a hedging instrument, where they're required to novate that to a central counterparty. The G20 had required some changes in the way that over-the-counter derivatives were managed and regulated, and so you've got different jurisdictions around the world introducing new rules, and for existing contracts that would get caught by this, in some jurisdictions there's a requirement for novation. Now, strictly speaking, under IAS 39 or IFRS 9 as currently written, that novation would require a cessation of the original hedge accounting, and then you could start to hedge account with the existing instrument, but just the post-novation. But if you were to do that, you would have a non-zero fair value for that derivative, which would then cause all sorts of ineffectiveness that would be thrown up on that and potentially cause you to fall out of the 80 to 125 scope that we have for hedge accounting. So given the very limited circumstances we're talking about there, where it's required, the novation is required by laws and regulations, then we said you should have an exception from the requirement to stop hedge accounting, allow you to continue with that in that limited circumstance. And because of the pending introduction of these new requirements, we needed to get that out very quickly, hence the very short comment period on that. Another topic that I wanted to also mention that isn't on the list here, but I think would be of interest that the Interpretations Committee is looking at, is discount rates used for measuring pension liabilities under IAS 19. We're talking about defined benefit pension plans. Now, the requirements in IAS 19 are for high-quality corporate bond rates to be used if there is a deep market, and then if there isn't, then looking at government bond rates. And questions had come to the Interpretations Committee because of deterioration in credit ratings for many companies was then reducing the population available for high-quality corporate bonds. Now, traditionally, high-quality corporate bonds have been seen as those with AAA or AA credit ratings. So questions were being asked, was it okay to extend the population to single A or perhaps even lower credit quality than that? And that was essentially the crux of the issue. Following discussions at the Interpretations Committee and at the board in the February board meeting, the Interpretations Committee is now going to be working on how we can provide clearer guidance and amend the guidance in IAS 19. The direction that the board has given is that the discount rate on the corporate bonds is not intended to be a risk-free rate, but is intended to be a risk-adjusted rate with a very sort of very low or minimal credit adjustment, so something consistent with AAA, AA. The board also gave a view that when you're looking at government bonds, if you've not got a deep market in the high-quality corporate bonds, those government bonds should also be high-quality as well. So the Interpretations Committee will be looking at their May meeting about how or what amendments could be made to IAS 19 to clarify that guidance. One of the other factors that the Interpretations Committee talked about at its most recent meeting in January was the question about what happens in a currency zone like the Eurozone. And there, the committee went a little bit further than it had done previously in talking about looking at the Eurozone as a whole, saying that if you have got a euro-denominated pension liability, then you really should be looking at the whole Eurozone and the population of high-quality corporate bonds throughout the whole of the Eurozone and seeing if you've got a deep market in that before you fall back to government bonds. And so that's something that we'll look to see whether we should be building in some additional guidance into IAS 19, building on the Interpretation Committee's views on that particular topic.
Any other questions?
Is it worth explaining briefly just how the things get into the narrow scope amendment list? Is that something that would be...
Can do. Happy to do that. I mean, as I say, many of these issues that are on the narrow scope amendments are issues that have come to the Interpretations Committee originally. The committee will look at that. They'll debate the technical issues. And then, having debated the technical issues and identified what it thinks would be an appropriate technical solution, it will then assess how that can be put into practice. If it's something that lends itself well to an interpretation of the existing literature, or if it's a very sort of narrow scope sort of clarification type of amendment, then it will propose either an interpretation or an annual improvement. But if it's something that needs an amendment to the standard to be done in the most efficient way and is beyond simply a clarification of what's already in the standards, then we're talking about a narrow scope amendment. And in those circumstances, it would then propose that solution to the board. But the board would then need to debate that and decide whether it agrees with the Interpretations Committee or not. The reason for getting the Interpretations Committee involved is that we're talking here about the application of the standards, so the current set of standards and applying those. And so the Interpretation Committee members obviously are bringing that day-to-day experience of applying standards, and they can do a fair chunk of the work on behalf of the ISB, hence freeing up more of the ISB's time for focusing on the main projects on its agenda, such as financial instruments, insurance, leases, etc.
Thank you. One quick comment on pensions. For the record, obviously users would not be happy if this discussion on discount rates is going to lead to using a higher discount rate with the subsequent benefit on the pension liability. So will there be any additional disclosures, perhaps, as part of additional guidance? If you're going to...
Additional disclosures is not something that we've been talking about. I mean, whenever the board is thinking about amendments or looking at amendments, it would naturally think about disclosures, but it would also be very conscious of what existing disclosure requirements are there at the moment and whether or not, in fact, those in conjunction with the amendments to the standard would provide the information that we think would be needed by users. But obviously that's something that we would...
It's probably because I'm not totally familiar with all the disclosures, but is there now a required disclosure to provide a basis for the discount rate? So yes, we're using high quality corporate bond yield, but in the given the absence, we're using an alternative. Is that something which is currently in the IAS 19? Disclosure requirements to provide some kind of motivation for this is the discount rate and this is what we've chosen?
There isn't, as far as I'm aware, a specific requirement about the discount rate that you're using, other than the standard requires a high quality corporate bond rate. What the standard does require, though, is that for all standards, in fact, if you are changing significant judgments, assumptions, etc., then there are the requirements to disclose details of that, both qualitative and quantitative, when you make those sorts of changes. So that should be flagged and highlighted if a company has been making any changes in that area.
Could you talk a little bit about the timeline? I'm not quite sure when you look at a research project versus a narrow scope amendment versus an interpretation, how quickly these things actually happen? When will we actually start seeing change?
Yeah, that will be dependent to some extent on the urgency of the issues. So the novation of derivatives one is a particularly urgent matter, and therefore we expect to see the amendment to the standard being published sort of the middle of this year. So that is less around about 6 months from start to finish on that one. Now that's an exception. Because in order to do that, we've had to cut back on our standard due process. Normally, we would expose any exposure draft for a minimum of 120 days. Given the normal due process requirements, we're typically looking at a year, 18 months for an amendment to an IFRS if it is particularly narrow and it is not particularly contentious. The more contentious something is, then the more outreach that naturally we would end up doing to make sure that we've understood the concerns that people have with a particular issue. On something like an interpretation, given that that is done, all the work for that is done by the Interpretations Committee, and they only meet every other month, rather than every month like the board does, we're typically looking at 2 years from start to finish for an interpretation to be developed, published for exposure, comments considered and re-deliberated, and the final interpretation issued.
Thank you.
Shall I pick up the points about the research agenda as well? If you look at page 4 of the work plan, there's a list of 10 research projects there. Those are all things where we're doing some preliminary research. And at the end of the research, the objective would be to consider adding something to the active agenda. Most likely, in most of those cases, we would publish a discussion paper first to get some external feedback as well before deciding whether to even consider adding it to the active agenda. Of those 10 items, there's nothing there where we're doing very active research at the moment. There are some where we did quite a lot of work in the past but suspended for various reasons. So there's nothing in that list of 10 that is that likely to come to a standard very quickly, within sort of 2 to 3 years. Once it's been added to the active agenda, then it goes through the process Michael talked about, which is moving towards an exposure draft and then a final standard. And you'd be looking at a minimum of 2 to 3 years for those.
All right, thank you.